Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. This episode is brought to you by 8 Sleep and NetSuite. I'm Charlie Sykes, and of course, we're doing this in real time. Listen to this. Here we go. Hear all this? This is in the background. We're all watching the Mueller testimony, the circus of all of that. And of course, who better to watch this with than Rick Wilson? So, Rick, you've been glued to this as well.
I have indeed been glued to it, like most of America, including our madcap president has been glued to it from the jump this morning. So it's the battle of the battle of the framing.
It is the battle of the framing. So this is one of those days when I really, really regret that I gave up morning drinking. Could I just start off by saying how absolutely absurd and annoying the 5-minute rule is for congressional testimony?
So dumb.
It is so dumb. Every representative is speed talking, and you can tell that they regard Mueller's responses as an interruption of their time. I mean, there's no interest whatsoever in actually listening to what he has to say. It's like, I have to get through all of this speech, and if I'm Matt Gaetz, I have to yell as loud as I possibly can. But the 5-minute thing has just thoroughly dumbed down this whole proceeding.
Yeah, the high speed, coked out, super fast, quote unquote questions from certain members of the body today, they came across as manic. And some of them came across as just completely off the rails. I mean, Louis Gohmert just scanned us even nuttier than Louis Gohmert usually scans.
Yeah, my favorite part was when Louis Gohmert cited the article, Robert Mueller Unmasked, which turns out to have been written by Louis Gohmert. you can't make this stuff up.
I'm not saying that Louis Gohmert regards his own writing very highly, but apparently he regards his own writing very highly.
So I started off this morning thinking, what would be the surprise, any possible surprise from the hearings? And, one surprise, of course, would be if the congressman did not be clown themselves, if the president did not rage tweet, or if, Robert Mueller stood up and, said to Matt Gaetz, have you no shame, at long last, have you no shame? But give me your take. Okay, before I get into this. You might recall the first time you appeared on a podcast with me, it was the Daily Standard podcast, when you and I were down in Austin, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And we were doing it the day of the Kavanaugh hearing where Dr. Blasey Ford had testified, but we were doing it in the middle of the day. And so this was after she testified, but before Brett Kavanaugh went on sort of his angry rebuttal. And I was, and I will confess this, I was convinced that he was done. You, however, to your eternal credit, said that he was going to be confirmed anyway. But it reminds me of the danger of engaging in this kind of punditry in the middle of testimony. But I have to say that one of my quick takeaways is that everybody's behaving badly. But I am kind of surprised at Robert Mueller, who does come off a little frail, a little shaky. And in terms of television, not that great.
This is one of those JFK Nixon questions where, if you were watching it on TV, you might mistake, I think, Mueller's caution and very probative nature for old man. I also think that the headlines are what's going to drive out of this hearing are absolutely devastating for the president. Charlie, what's happening today is we're watching a hearing that is designed for two separate audiences. The Democrats want to introduce Americans who have not read the Mueller report by and large. And by and large, I mean, there are probably about 500 people in the country who've actually read the whole thing cover. And the Republicans are there to do show prep for tonight's Fox News, evening broadcasts. And you can see where the framing's already going. And the Republicans are, and here's an irony for you. The Republicans who are saying, oh, Mueller's senile, he's old, he's doddering. Had they looked at Donald Trump? Had they watched him speak? Had they observed any of his behaviors? Because, if you want to talk about creeping dementia, Donald Trump's got it in spades. But I think a lot of the things people are missing is, that, again, that Mueller has a very cautious role to play. and he is not going to get out in front of things, and he's not going to make mistakes. And so if he has to say things like, can you repeat that question, or I didn't hear you clearly, or let's go back and read it directly from the report, some of that is his very strong desire not to screw up, his very strong desire not to have a moment where he comes across as crossing the line politically, or looking like this was a partisan investigation, or going in some direction that will allow Trump and company to turn it into even more of a circus.
Yeah, and because I'm going to just keep, you know, on this as a television show, which is a little bit unfair, but this is the reality, you know. And as a television show, though, he does seem, you know, less prepared and more uncertain than I would have expected from him. Does seem a little bit rusty. Now, again,
he's got a very narrow lane in which he can operate.
Well, that's true. And also, he's having these questions fired at him, you know, rapid fire, you know, specific dates, specific pages. And before he has a chance to even check what it is, they move on. As I said before, they're no interest in actually hearing
his, on April 14th, did you take a dump at 9:04 p.m.? You know, that.
Well, and then boom, they move on to the next one. You know, and so that is the case. And you're absolutely right, though. You're framing the various narratives. And so who's doing a better job framing the narratives? Because as I was listening, I see that's going to be a soundbite on Fox. That's going to be a soundbite on MSNBC.
If you look at the top of Drudge, it is all about, you know, the Fox angle of this. He's frail. He's doddering. He's ancient. And right now they're going to win that battle. But the biggest takeaway out of this, I think, came in the first 90 seconds when Nadler asked him, did your report exonerate Donald Trump? And he said, no. And I think that is a moment that is going to be the thing that sets up the framing of this conclusion today. And look, I came into this with my expectations firmly in check. The bank shot strategy of have these hearings, get the story out, then America will be ready to impeach Donald Trump, and then we'll pass it in the House and the Senate will convict him, requires four separate improbable steps. And as much as I think that the Trump campaign did in fact engage with Russia in ways that were illegal, and as much as that in fact we have established that the Russians set out to elect Donald Trump because they knew he would be a cat's paw for Vladimir Putin, all of these things do not get you to the point where the Senate is going to convict Trump. And if you impeach him in the House and it fails in the Senate, he gets to spend the next year and a half walking around with his junk swinging out, saying, I was exonerated, completely exonerated. The Democrats couldn't get me. Ha, 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 ha. You cannot shame him. Therefore, unless you can actually do something that punishes him and removes him from office, you're wasting your time and you're helping him.
So one of the big questions was whether or not these hearings today, and there are two of them, would provide momentum for that impeachment move. And again, you know, early in the morning after a couple of hours, my gut sense is, and again, this is midstream, we could be completely wrong,
right.
I don't feel that there's going to be that kind of momentum. But you're right. This is an important thing. It's not what you're thinking in the actual moment, focusing on the atmospherics and the optics of Robert Mueller that are going to determine this. It will be those sound bites and it will be those headlines. And you focus on that first 90 seconds where he specifically asked, did you exonerate the president? No. And that's got to be one of the headlines. I mean, there may be analysis headlines that Mueller didn't do that well, but the main headline is, Robert Mueller, did you exonerate the president? No.
Yeah, that's the big takeaway from today so far. And I think it's important to remember there are a lot of things coming out of the Democratic Party's questioning today that actually, I mean, by some miracle, seems relatively organized. There's not a lot of Democrat showboating and screeching. I think that they've done a pretty credible job so far of getting to some of the things inside the questions of both obstruction and of the president's behavior in trying to fire Mueller and to frame this out in a way that talks that removes some of these sort of hand-waving legal defenses the Trump team had been using to try to spin the president's culpability towards obstruction, particularly.
Now, some of the stronger points from the Republicans, you know, going after, you know, why did you make this decision? Why did you say that you could not charge him, you know, come to a conclusion on obstruction of justice when you came to a conclusion on the conspiracy slash collusion, which is a whole different issue, and some of the other issues of, you know, what about the president's presumption of innocence? You know, some of those were, you know, had a certain level of plausibility, but they don't go to the fundamental, I think, heart of what's going to come out of this hearing, which is, you know, what was the scope of the scandal? What was the president's culpability? And I do think that the Democrats, to the extent that they are succeeding, is they are hammering away on this obstruction of justice. And I was really struck this morning, at least, how many of them concluded their statements by using almost the identical phrase that no one is above the law. The president is not above the law. And they keep hammering that point so that you're right. There is a certain amount of message discipline.
There is, and which is surprising because the Democrats can normally, you know, screw up a two-car motorcade.
Yes, which we've talked about before, and I think they're still in the process of doing all of this. So here's a little bit of a digression. I've gone back and, you know, tried to get away from all of this. I'm actually reading Whitaker Chambers' book, Witness. Classic book.
It's
a fantastic read. I strongly recommend it to anybody. And it's the Hiss Whitaker Chamber, the Hiss Chambers case. Mm-hmm. And he has lengthy transcripts of some of the congressional hearings where he is testifying and Alger Hiss is testifying. And what really struck me this morning, having spent the evening reading this, was how much more in depth they were back then. They didn't have a 5-minute rule. They actually were able to probe. They were actually able to ask follow-up questions. There was appeared to be a genuine interest in getting details, in getting answers. It was nothing like what we saw this morning. This morning really was circus-like compared to those investigations, which of course now in revisionist history we look back, well, that was the witch hunt and everything. No, it turned out to be quite substantive.
Yeah, the Chambers parallel is one that, as controversial as it may look in hindsight, these were revelations that were being put together for the first time by somebody who was inside the operation. And Robert Mueller is giving people some insight today that has been very difficult to get out for two reasons. One, he is very much a sort of hidebound, rule-bound traditionalist. And number two, Bill Barr, very effectively in terms of the politics of it, pinned Mueller down by mischaracterizing his report and essentially daring Robert Mueller to come out and say something about it. And it was that vice that Mueller found himself in is opened slightly today by some of the questions from the Democrats, which have been pretty smart overall.
No, it is. I want to go back to, I just opened up the Drudge Report because you mentioned it. And the Drudge Report for our listeners is really often the assignment editor for much of the conservative media. I think that's a fair statement.
Absolutely.
Okay. So it has Mueller Live, you know, him standing there with his hand up. And here are the headlines, the links. My report did not exonerate Trump is actually the first line. Can be indicted after office is the second line. Confused, stuttering, could you repeat the question? That's the third, which, again, is part of this. You're going to hear that a lot on Fox News. Live tracking deflections, frail performance. This is painful. Dem day of disappointments, media frenzy, read opening statement latest. So again, this is at, we're doing this at about, 11:15 Eastern Standard Time. That is the spin. But we'll see at the end, because those two top points, even the Drudge Report mentioned, you know, no exoneration and the fact that you can be indicted after leaving office. It is interesting. And this is, I guess, part of my disappointment. I always have this disappointment of debates and watching things is thinking, you could have stated it this way. You could have made it very, very clear. If Mueller gave a crystal clear answer that, yes, we felt we needed to document the obstructive acts, the obstruction of justice, because number one, we wanted to preserve the record because, in fact, the president can be indicted after leaving office. And number two, this would fall under the purview of Congress's oversight. If he would have stated that very, very clearly, I think that would have had a tremendous impact. But
we may still get there.
Well, that's right.
But you know, the day is still ongoing. But I mean, when you look at the headlines broadly, you know, latest, Mueller dismisses Trump's claim of exoneration. Mueller says Trump not exculpated for obstruction of justice. No exoneration. Mueller contradicts Trump. Mm-hmm. Mueller undercuts Trump claims about special counsel report. Mueller says Trump is lying about his report. Mueller, report is not exoneration of President Trump. and on and on and on and on. Mueller to Congress, Trump's wrong. I didn't exonerate him. You know, these things, these things will have a pileup effect. And I think that the coverage you're going to see today and tonight is going to have a pileup effect. And this is why Donald Trump, you know, tweeted 10 times this morning and is right now being held down with, you know, leather straps in a chair while he's trying to tear his own arm off to get to his phone to tweet. You know, and Ivanka and Kellyanne and the rest are trying to like hold him down with tasers and tranquilizer darts, because this is not a good look for him being so out of control. And if the only framing of this situation is that Robert Mueller is old and is not answering questions immediately while he's checking the notes and checking the record, you know, I don't think that's a great look for them. And I don't think it necessarily is a decisive win condition, given the fact that the obstruction question is now out there again. The whole total exoneration, no obstruction, no collusion, two of those three assertions are now in the gutter.
I want to move on in just a moment, but you know, as I was, you know, watching the first segment, and I was thinking, ooh, you know, this is not going that well. I did hear somebody make a really interesting point. I can't remember who it was, so I won't try to pretend that I do. In pointing out that, you know, look, Robert Mueller is in many ways a throwback. I mean, he is from a different time, a man who, for whom truth and accuracy and honor are more important and more important than showboating and sound bites. And really, you had that, you know, that's one way of framing this, to understand, you know, the real contrast. You know, Matt Gaetz versus Robert Mueller is really an indication of what the Republican Party might have once been and what it's become right now. And so does he, you know, turn in a shaky performance in this reality TV show soundbite era of 5-minute questioning? Yeah, maybe. But that's more of an indictment of the new culture than it is of Robert Mueller. And I thought that was actually, I've kind of put my own gloss on that. But I actually thought that was a legitimate point. OK, so let's talk about some other things. You wrote extensively and rather passionately about the president's racist tweets from last week. And I wanted to get some sense from you where you're coming down on this epic debate of the four-dimensional chess strategic plan to racialize the election versus, you know, the ranty grandpa just shoots something out with no thought. I've come down on the reptilian cunning phase.
Yes,
but
I think Donald Trump's lizard brain has internalized two big things. One, that the Democrats do not understand. We've talked about this before. They keep thinking this election is about winning voter turnout in California and New York and Massachusetts and Washington and Oregon. A large majority in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Florida are white. A large majority of those people are old. A large majority of those people are dudes. This is for Donald Trump's pissed off, white, angry dude audience. He needs those guys to come out. He needs to goose them a couple of points this time, and he's doing it. Now, is his strategy really considered? Has he thought it all through? No, of course not. He's Donald Trump. But that feral cunning, that lizard brain, as you said, is one of his great skills in understanding that he is an avatar for people who are angry and who are racially conscious of their white identity politics in ways that that he weaponized in 2016, and he will do it again this time. He doesn't mind being called a racist because he is one.
Right, and that's baked in. I would be interested to know how many images of those four women, those four minority women, have been, how many times that was disseminated on pro-Trump Facebook pages, because that is the lizard brain saying, this is the image I want, this is the face of the Democratic Party. If I can run, I mean, on one level, I'm running against radical socialists, but I'm running against radical socialists who look like this, who have headscarves. And you're absolutely right. This does, and he gets this at the lizard brain level, this does appeal to his core voters in the states that you mention. And I don't know how many times we have to make the point this is all about the Electoral College. You know, stop debating about whether or not the Electoral College is right or wrong. You can get in 90% of the vote in California, and it won't matter if you lose Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and
Arizona,
Iowa.
Florida.
Right, exactly. It does not matter. And right now, you have a lot of the discussion sort of assuming that, well, this is going to backfire, in a lot of places that, frankly, are not going to determine who gets 270 electoral votes. Now, you have been pounding your head against the table trying to get Democrats to focus on this. And are you having any success?
No, I'm not.
Me neither.
And I will tell you that the response that I get, I know this is my favorite response that I get from woke Twitter. When I make these points, I will get people who say, well, you helped run horrible campaigns against our candidates for years and years, and why should we listen to you? It's like, because we took 1,100 seats from you in a 10-year period, because we captured 38 state legislative bodies in a 10-year period, because we know how to hack the Democratic process, the Democratic campaign process, and turn it against you. And the Republicans are – and Donald Trump, we can all assert confidently – is a goddamn moron. He is a stupid man, but he is a stupid man surrounded right now by a bunch of very smart people who are going to do everything they can to minimize and chain his stupidity down and run a campaign in the targeted states that will win back the same demo he got last time, that will goose those Democratic men over the line for him. They will identify small issues. They will narrow cast them. And Democrats that are out there talking about getting rid of the Electoral College or reparations or gender bathrooms or any of this other shit that is on their wish list, they are putting the cart before the horse. Win first, then make policy. There is nothing that policy will bring them in this election. Nothing.
You're making a great point here about the sort of knee-jerk rejection. Well, you folks are Republicans. We don't need to listen to all of you. It's like, no, listen, we know how folks think. We know how to move the needle, and we know what he is doing and how this is going to play. I mean, I can certainly imagine going out to talk to some of my friends, a few counties out here in southeastern Wisconsin, and maybe we would talk about the various terrible things Trump did, and they would be nodding their heads and they would be agreeing. And at some point in the conversation, somebody would say, but yeah, that Ilhan Omar or that AOC, or they want to take away our, private health insurance. And it would be, and it's such an easy turn to make that, Trump is really offensive, but these people are dangerous. And he has, whether it's, great strategic thinking or not, they, made this a referendum on people like this. By the way, did you notice what that vote on the BDS resolution was yesterday? The boycott to
317 to something?
Yeah, like I think it was 319 to 17.
Right.
17 votes. So all of this talk about how influential the squad was, and I was wondering, why would Nancy Pelosi allow this to come to a vote? Well, maybe it's to demonstrate that these guys are not just a minority. They're a minority within a minority. They are the fringe within the fringe of the Democratic Party. And
listen, yet, I've said this a lot, Charlie. You give me 50 Connor Lambs or 50 Katie Porters, and I can win 50 more seats for the Democrats. You give me 50 AOCs and I can win two, because she exists and the squad exists in these D plus 15, D plus 20 hothouse little boutique districts that are not replicated at scale around the country. And I know it just drives people crazy on the left to be told that a Connor Lamb looks a lot more like Pennsylvania and looks a lot more like the seats they want to get out in middle America than to the members of the squad. And look, ideologically, I Republicans, are using this whole, like, they're socialists. And here's what I always say about socialists. It's lucky they're so goddamn bad at what they do and that their ideology always collapses in on itself, because they'd terrify me otherwise. But they're so bad at what they do, and these people are no different. I mean, you listen to their economic talk, and it's basically like college dorm room freshman year bullshit sessions of, actually, true communism has never been tried. And it's just – Trump elevating them was smart, feral politics and tribal politics. But the Democrats who think Nancy Pelosi is their enemy for trying to contain wild talk, they're truly nuts.
So we're talking with Rick Wilson. I want to talk about this week's other horror that has maybe been eclipsed a little bit. But first, I want to hear from our sponsors. Our sponsor today is NetSuite.com. Look, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have, the problem that keeps them from knowing their numbers, is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another one for sales, another one for inventory, and so on. It's just a big inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. So, introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing all of your sales, finance, accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. And that's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/bulwark. That's netsuite.com/bulwark to download your free, completely free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, netsuite.com/bulwark. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. Only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first 2 batches, so they're going fast. For limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHT sleep.com/bulwark. So we're back with Rick Wilson. Now, Rick, right before we started this podcast, we were talking about whether we're going to talk about anything other than the Mueller testimony. And you brought up the big budget deal,
right,
which is going to add $300 billion to spending. It's going to lead to $1 trillion a year deficits this year. And you said you were concerned about this. And my gut reaction was, well, so you're the other guy.
Right. I mean, I feel like we're, maybe it's very old fashioned to think that maybe kind of sort of we ought to think about fiscal probity. But apparently not. Apparently now, look, one of my favorite quotes about politics is was Emerson said of Lincoln's government that an institution is the lengthened shadow of a man. And the shape of a government reflects the person at the head of it. Well, Trump is a guy who's managed to go bankrupt 4 or 5 times. He's the only human being in the history of mankind who's lost money running a casino. He's lived from bankruptcy to disaster to an endless cycle of financial ups and downs that required a series of greater fool lenders to come and bail him out. So of course he looks at the federal government in the same economic theoretical frame that AOC does with this whole silly modern monetary theory case. They think that money is free, that it exists not because it's tied to economic activity or services, but because it exists because they want it to exist. It's like, oh, I have more checks in my checkbook, I can't be out of money.
But it's so tragic.
Right, so here we are right now waiting for the next economic collapse when we will be out of airspeed, altitude, and ideas on how to manage it, because we won't be able to go and tap gigantic reserves of easy money. We've tapped them. We tapped them in the good times. We're spending all of our seed corn, eating all of our seed corn and spending all of our capital in the good times to maintain an economic bubble for political reasons. And I was critical of this kind of spending during Bush and during Obama. And I don't know, maybe that makes me a rhino shill sellout cuck, but maybe it makes me a traditional fiscal conservative. I don't know.
Well, it makes you obsolete, right? An anachronism. I mean, I spend, you know, look, I, you know, sitting here in Wisconsin and, you know, had at least 100 interviews or events with Paul Ryan on the threat of the debts and entitlements. I mean, I watched every one of his YouTube videos with his charts. Ron Johnson, before he became a complete Trumpkin, used to go around with the same charts. And I, you know, part of me thinks, was I a sucker because I believed all of this? I said, this is the greatest intergenerational transfer of wealth in human history. It's going to create a debt crisis. We are only a few years away from all of this. You know, this is fundamentally wrong. The great challenge of our time is to avert this incredibly predictable fiscal crisis. And suddenly it's like, hey, never mind. we didn't mean any of it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's this now laughable, this laughable change of, oh, you know, we're the party of fiscal conservatism and of economic stability. Well, again, it is the same modern monetary theory that says that sovereign debt isn't debt. Sovereign wealth can be created at whatever basis we want for however long we want and whatever amounts we want because we say so. And, you know, economics is a cruel mistress and she always gets her way in the end.
And there's two really revealing quotes that have been attributed to Donald Trump. One is that Mitch McConnell told him, nobody's ever lost an election by spending more money. And number two, when Donald Trump is presented with information about the deficit and the debt, saying, "Well, you know, I don't have to worry about that because I won't be around when that happens,"
right.
which are not totally exclusive to Trump. That sort of cynicism, that I need to get through the next election. And I don't need to worry about the consequences because, hey, that's going to be somebody else's problem. I think Obama had a little bit of that as well.
Sure.
Well, actually, every president has had. Otherwise, they would have actually been serious about the deficit and the debt. And, of course, this will have, and I go back to this, this will have no impact on the incredible loyalty of the Freedom Caucus to Donald Trump, even though the Freedom Caucus at one point existed for the explicit reason of fighting against this kind of fiscal policy.
Correct. And there's nothing in the Freedom Caucus, the last decade of their history, that they stood for more than the opposition to Barack Obama's reckless spending and the opposition to Barack Obama's reckless expansion of government and of power, and Barack Obama's executive orders, and Barack Obama's wild intrusions into picking winners and losers in the economy. And every single one of those things, every last one of those things, has now become something that they every day go, oh, no, Trump doing that is totally different. It's totally different when he picks winners and losers because why? Because what?
So I have a more cosmic, more difficult question for you, a little bit more heavy lifting, and I had to wrestle with this yesterday. Imagine yourself, or remember, what you were thinking on January 20th, 2009, when Barack Obama was sworn in, and remember January 20th, 2017, when Donald Trump was sworn in. What the hell happened? How did we go as a country from that moment to where we are right now? And the person who asked me this, and I actually said to the person who asked me this, I said, well, you know, that's above my pay grade. That's why you get paid the big bucks. And he says, no, that's why I'm asking you this question. And I said, I will tell you, it continues to be a mind-blowing, you know, a just having experienced it, it is still mind-blowing. I think historians are going to have a very difficult time in the future, having much more information than we have, sorting all of that out. But what do you think, Rick Wilson? How did we go from that to this?
The transition phase was this black swan moment that combined older, wider audience that was tuned into one television network that became the single normative function of Republican politics, which is to say Fox, at a moment when a guy with built-in name ID as a reality TV star managed to kill off all the people that claimed they had the principles and the things about that Republicans said they believed in. it all came together in this one moment against the perfect candidate against them, which was Hillary Clinton, whom we'd all spent, you know, roughly 25 years turning into the demonic queen of hell. And so this moment came together, and it's unfortunately stripped bare something that we thought we believed in on all these different areas of conservative principle. Turns out that the base didn't believe in those things.
Yeah, I know.
They
yeah.
wanted the show. They wanted the spectacle. They wanted the anger. And we trained them. I wrote about this in my first book. We trained them over and over again to be pissed, to be furious, and to approach that fury with a kind of fatalism that the other side are the elites. They're the smart ones. They're the ones who control everything. They're the secret, you know, overlords of the world. You know, we can't fight back because George Soros or whatever other, you know, demon in the closet that day. And so we trained them to the point where Donald Trump, when he picked up the control panel to this machine, there was nothing we could do to stop it.
Yeah.
And
it feels that way.
There is no solution at this point right now, because in the Republican Party, there's a sense that this is the final battle. This is the apocalypse. You know, if Trump loses, you know, the world slides into Sharia communism or something. And
I've heard that.
And if there was a conservative party that was an alternative, it might be one thing, but it's impossible to build one, given that right now the Republican base is so convinced that if they do anything against Trump, they will either be destroyed by him or destroyed by you know, this amorphous, gigantic, you know, liberal conspiracy to cause the world to become socialist.
Yeah, well, and you know, that, I think that explanation is right on target. But also, you have to layer in the incredible dislocation of the Great Recession and
sure,
and the huge population that did feel that they were being ignored and they were being looked down upon. And both political parties, I think, really look the other way. We're not paying that much attention. I think the Republicans thought that you could keep the white working class electorate in line by throwing them sort of boob bait, various social, you know, social issues. And so when Donald Trump steps up and he says, I am going to appeal to the forgotten voter, it actually had more resonance. And the disdain and the contempt that the left had for many of those voters had also been seeping through and really, you know, had become indelible at a certain point. And you look back on the Obama years, and you know, everything you're saying is true, but also you did have the left at ramming speed, which fed that narrative that they're coming for you, they want to destroy everything you believe in, et cetera. It really was the perfect storm. My concern is, though, is how much long-term damage, and I know that you've written about this extensively. You take Donald Trump out of the picture, and I think it's going to take us a really long time, maybe a generation or more, to recover from this.
I think this.
Are you more optimistic than me?
You know, I'm actually more pessimistic. I think we've broken the fundamental baseline of you know, limited government, rule of law, conservatism, and replaced it with populist authoritarianism, and that is a powerful drug. And authoritarian regimes expand and continue until they are violently brought to an end. And I'm not suggesting that's the only way to get rid of Trump, but there will have to be a phase change in our politics that's so disastrous on both ends. The left's going to have to overshoot wildly, and the right's going to have to basically, you know, have to pay the terrible price of Trumpism, which, you know. One of the great things that's been a telling moment for me about how broken the party is they look at 2018 as a total victory. They're like, oh, well, we got rid of the rhino squishes in 2018, so we're pure now. And I think it's just a very dangerous spot to be in as a party. But on the other hand, you know, the Democrats are holistically terrible at politics. They do tend to overshoot. They do operate from a series of economic predicates that are not going to address. And one of the reasons Donald Trump was able to be so effective with those white working class voters is that for years, what have the Democrats promised? Oh, job training. You're going to all build solar panels, and you're going to go to computer camp, and you're going to learn to code, and you're going to get jobs that are just like those jobs you had at a factory, you know, in a Ford factory in Dearborn, and it's going to make the high school graduate able to you know, afford to raise kids and send them to college and live a good life and have a good retirement. It's a lie. Democrats were telling them a lie. Well, Trump's telling them a separate lie, but that change in our politics, that resentment and distrust in our politics is so powerful that you know we're in a world of hurt.
And of course, when the more the Democrats talk about things like white privilege, that just reinforces it. I've actually tried to make the case. You understand that if you're talking to voters in rural Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, who've seen their communities hollowed out, who've seen a lot of their families ravaged by the opioid epidemic, who really no longer think that their children are going to live better than they do. And they look to the Democrats, and the Democrats are talking about white privilege. They go, I'm not privileged. What are you talking about?
Right.
It is this fundamental disconnect that I actually see widening rather than narrowing at the moment when really Democrats ought to understand exactly what is at stake.
They really should, and unfortunately, they would much rather litigate the things on their wish list than to engage in practical, real politics. And I've begged and pleaded and tried to beat them into submission on it, but it is hard to penetrate the idea that they hold very dear, which is that every American is this secret, super progressive, dying to get out. And they're not. And, I had a conversation with somebody recently about why Andrew Gillum lost in Florida. And, you know, he put up a very competitive campaign. But I'll tell you why he lost in Florida. He lost in Florida because he came out and talked about banning semi-automatic weapons. And North Florida, white male Democrats in North Florida, they're a lot like rural Democrats in Wisconsin. They like their guns. And when Democrats say we just want gun safety, they hear, you're coming to take my deer rifle. Doesn't matter how many times you Democrats try to correct them, that's what they hear. And Republicans exploit the living hell out of that. And that's why Andrew Gillum, in terms of white Democratic voters north of I-4, got wiped out.
Well, he was also proposing an income tax, right? A state income tax, Florida does not have.
And that destroyed him in areas that Barack Obama won handily, where he could have done very well with some softer suburban voters who came here from New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania because
and Wisconsin.
There's no income tax here and property taxes are relatively low.
Yeah, half of Wisconsin lives in Florida for two reasons. Number one, the weather's much better. And number two, there's no income tax.
Correct. So
the moment you have a candidate who goes, hey, I want to impose an income tax, I don't know what the number of transplants is, but most of those people are going, whoa, 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 we came here specifically because you didn't have that.
Right. And you know, Democrats have this idea that policy will triumph. They love policy. They love it, love it, love it. And they love having plans. You know, no election is ever won by an actual plan or an actual policy, especially no re-election. Incumbent re-elections are always a referendum on the current office holder. And, you know, if they don't think this election is a referendum on Donald Trump, they are mistaken.
Rick Wilson, thank you so much for joining us again on the Bulwark Podcast. And we'll see what all the fallout is after.
My pleasure.
Probably
as always, Charlie.
Yeah, it'll take probably 48 hours. Hey, but it is great talking with you.
Likewise, sir.
And today's Bulwark Podcast was brought to you by 8 Sleep and by NetSuite. And we are very grateful for that support. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.